like I brought here and I brought back with
test
and all this material here. Right?
Oh, wonderful, thank you. Test. I think we're on. Let me see.
An entirely different class of car, meaning a smaller, lightweight car.
Mm-hmm.
You can't just start modifying a basic U.S. automobile. And the Japanese, of course, had perfected that, were in the process of perfecting it quite effectively.
Mm-hmm.
And I had been running our international business years before, and had gotten to know people at Renault and also at Fiat, and I had previously made a trip through Germany and interviewed people that looked, thinking in my mind really what the prospects might be for a merger of some nature. I spent quite a little time with Agnelli at Fiat, but they had had a unhappy experience in this country, if you recall. And they finally just discontinued distribution in the U.S. And I've forgotten what they called it, but they're just the Fiat automobile. They were just importing it.
The small Fiat.
Yeah, and they had a very effective man here, but whom I knew, and he and I went to see Agnelli, and we had some good talks, but I could see it wasn't going to get very far. Now, this, as I say, was some time ago, but at the same time, I had spent, I'd become really quite good personal friends with a fellow named Bernier Paez, who was the, who at that time was the maybe third guy in line at Renault. And one thing led to another, and we got to the point where we became very comfortable with one another. He was a perfectly wonderful man. Incidentally, after he left Renault, he became the ambassador to the United States from France. And he was in Washington for several years. His name is Bernard, is his first name. Bernier, V-E-R-N-I-E-R dash P-A-I-L-L-E-Z. And you know, we were friends to the point where they came and visited us in Nantucket and that sort of thing. And he was the real mover behind the putting together the two companies. Renault, for reasons of their own, were absolutely adamant that they did not want control of American Motors, and they had 48%, and that was it. Now, they had some subordinated notes of some kind, I've forgotten exactly what now, that could be converted into stock, and which might have given, but they were quite explicit in the fact that they did not want to be in a position of controlling the company. As I say, it was very difficult for me to understand why. It has something to do with their feeling that maybe they didn't want to be thought of as a French company that owns an American company. In any case, we embarked on an import program and subsequently an assembly program. And
how was it set up? I've often wondered how that was affected in terms of the product that came over here from Renault.
I mean, what did we do to the product that came?
Were they assembled in France?
Yes, but they were modified to American, primarily safety standards.
There or here?
They were done in France, as I recall it. In any case, it was a good relationship, that because they were a progressive company, and even though this is not the politic way of saying it, they were government owned, but the French government at that time pretty much left them to themselves, let them run it, and they had some very good automobile men in there, I'll tell you one little anecdote. The fellow who ultimately, who finally came over here from Renault after a year or two and became president of American Motors.
Mm-hmm. What was his name?
I'm trying to, I know you're going to want me to spell it. I'm trying to remember the spelling. His name was Jose, J-O-S-E, Deurawaerder, Deurawaerder.
That's well
known. Yeah, Josie was here for some time, mm-hmm. but just coincidentally, Josie was had been running a plant in Belgium back in the early 60s when I went over and convinced Renault that they ought to distribute Rambler automobiles. And Josie was the one who had to do the modifying in Europe to make of the Rambler a, quote, big car, because it was, Renault at that time didn't have any large car, in effect, to compete with Citroën and others. And they were very eager to see that, that De Gaulle rode in a Renault. So we took a Rambler Classic, if you remember that. Well, this is a flashback, obviously, but I think it's kind of interesting in its ultimate impact. The Classic was, you know, the lowest priced American automobile, but dimensionally it fit just what Renault was looking for. So we took a Classic over there, and I mean literally Jose and I, he was then their plant manager at Arren, Belgium, H-A-R-E-N, which was an assembly plant, and modified it. We put broadcloth upholstery in it. We took all the bright work trim off it. We made a really kind of a, and it was sort of basically a classic looking car anyway. And by the time we got through fooling around with it, oh, we put a chauffeur's partition in it and so on and so forth, we really had a quite a presentable car. Unfortunately, it was not the kind of a car that was going to sell in any volume. But they sold, I don't know, maybe 5,000-6,000, something like that. That may even be optimistic. But their dealers would each buy one, and then they'd sell it, and then they might buy another, that kind of thing. But it gave them a car so that, as I said, there was an armored version of it, which De Gaulle used. Chase Bank had one to pick up customers at the airport and bring them to their offices. And, you know, there was that kind of a vehicle. And it had a Renault nameplate on it. So that was an experience, and it tried, Josie being a production man, it drove him nuts to have to do this to modify a vehicle, which he knew he was going to have only a little volume with anyway. And years later, in 70, must have been 8 or 9, whenever it was he came over here, I knew they were sending a fellow over, and I really wasn't, I didn't pay a whole lot of attention, and I was going to be the vice president of manufacturing, I guess, or at least working in manufacturing. And he walked in the door, and he looked at me, and I looked at him. He said, "Oh my God." He said, "You remember our days in Arren, Belgium?" I said, "I certainly do." And he was a really terrific guy. We still are in correspond with one another. He is now running a big brewery in Belgium. He's out of the automobile business. But that is a lapse, maybe, but to bring it up to date, he was instrumental in what went on in American Motors for quite a few years as the manufacturing head. One other evidence that's kind of interesting is that Francois Castaing, Francois Castaing, who was our chief engineer, is now the vice president of all Chrysler Engineering, as you perhaps know. And so we had some very interesting people, and things went, you know, reasonably well. It didn't go as well as they should have, for all of, you know, there are all kinds of people that would like to explain why. But what really finally terminated the Renault relationship with American Motors, in my opinion, and I'm pretty certain of this, was the change in government. When the socialists and Mitterrand came in, Mitterrand, came in, they changed management at Renault. Vernier Pryse was out. Another fellow who had followed him, who was an excellent automobile man, came in. They put a fellow who was a nice enough man, but he was a bureaucrat. He didn't know anything about the automobile business, in charge of the company. And bit by bit, it became quite apparent that they were just trying to find a way out. And finally, they put a gentleman named Levy, L-E-V-Y, in, who was still there. And he was a person with whom it was very difficult for us to do anything. He obviously had a mission, which is to, yeah, I won't do that. And then the mission was, again, this is my opinion, the mission was to extricate Renault from their deal with American Motors. Renault was losing a lot of money, and
yes,
and
I,
give,
I had
yeah,
that impression.
Yeah, and the attitude was, look, we're not going to pour any, and we were losing money,
mm-hmm.
and we're not going to pour any more money into America because we're not getting anywhere. We really don't have any piece of the market. It's perfectly understandable,
mm-hmm.
but it was in my mind unfortunate because I don't think it had to turn out that way. However, it did. And that resulted in the ultimate decision to break. Now, they were smart enough to not make the break until they had arranged to deal with Chrysler.
Mm-hmm.
They did that themselves. I don't know how publicized this is going to be, but
yeah.
Yes, yeah, they negotiated the sale of their 48% interest to Chrysler without bothering to tell us about it.
Really?
And I can go into excruciating detail on that because I was pretty upset about it, as were others. However, they, God bless them, I mean, they had to look out for their own skin, and they did.
Was it a done deal before you heard about it, or was it pretty much so?
Effectively.
Yeah.
And
we
had a pretty good idea what was going on, but nobody would admit it. And then when it was done, why, as I said, with 48% of the company already in other hands, why, that was it. There was wasn't any question about who was going to be able to take over the entire company.
Did you have a hope or a feeling that you might be able to work harmoniously with Chrysler in a tandem situation?
Probably not. We didn't, because we didn't have really much of an automotive product line at that time. Basically, but it was a relatively low volume, specialized kind of car. Excellent car, as it turned out, but Jeep was the mainstay. And we did some heavy calculating on whether we could just say, well, we're going to split Jeep off and run it as a company unto itself,
mm-hmm.
and that had major obstacles. One of them being money. And so we finally concluded that we couldn't go that way, and which, from Chrysler's point of view, of course, was a boon because to them having the Jeep was probably the main, if not the main attraction of American Motors at that time. So it turned out they got a lot of very good people.
How were the discussions initiated? Do you remember any of the details?
With whom?
With Chrysler.
As far as Renault is concerned?
Well, that if you wish to talk about, but...
Well, Renault came to us and said, look, we've made this deal now. You better sit down and talk to him about what happens to the other 52%.
And who do you remember talking to about?
There were three of us, Paul Tippett, myself,
mm-hmm.
and I hate to tell you, I forgot the name of the third fellow, but I'll think of it. And we negotiated with Ben Bidwell.
Oh, yeah.
And... Steve Miller.
Oh, yeah.
Steve was really kind of the lead man. Who was then the head chief financial guy.
Really financial.
And it was kind of an agonizing sort of negotiation because they wanted to do it in New York. I'm living in California.
Mm-hmm.
I made five round trips to New York in 2 weeks or something like that because, you know, they'd say, well, we're not getting anywhere, goodbye. And what I, you know, they hadn't, Lee never showed up for any of the discussions, so I'm sure what happened was they went back and talked to Lee, and he said, well, all we were trying to do with not a very strong hand, as you can guess,
mm-hmm.
was to get as much as we could for the 52% of the shares that were owned by American, generally speaking, American shareholders.
You were aware, of course, of they wanted Jeep. Did you feel you were in something of a bargaining position with that?
Well, yeah, but it was with 48% already in their hands. You know, in most places, in most mergers or takeovers, if you got 48%, just forget it. You know you're going to get the other three that you need or
right.
whatever it is. So,
okay.
You couldn't push that card too far.
Mm-hmm.
And we took, we spent all the month of April, I guess that was 87, wasn't it? Yeah. And finally came up with the best deal we felt we could make and to which they agreed. And then those things take a little while to put together, so the actual takeover, as I recall, or the actual consummation of the sale was August of 87.
Mm-hmm.
And that's it.
So Bidwell was the highest member you talked to?
Well, actually, Steve Miller was.
Steve Miller.
Yeah, Steve was the. I think he was a vice chairman, and he was certainly the executive vice president in charge of all the financial aspects of the company. He was the guy that, and you know, we had the usual accompaniment of investment bankers.
Yes.
And
usual customers.
God bless them. and you know, they went. I've got a whole briefcase here full of studies as to why it ought to be $4.83 instead of $4.72 a share, and that kind of stuff, which was, you had to go through it, I guess.
What was the actual selling price per share?
I think it was $4.50.
Yeah.
And and that could be wrong, man. That's pretty close. And it was, you know, I didn't thoroughly enjoy the process of negotiating it, but it had to be done. And I was probably as knowledgeable about it at that time as anybody. So that's how it turned out.
I don't want to leave this quite so abruptly, but what about the Alliance? It seemed to go fairly well.
It was a very good car. Yeah. It was a Renault R18 or some number like that. And, you know, these things fade out of your memory. It was a remake, you might say, or a modification of a Renault, an existing Renault automobile, and it was a good car. There were some things about it that I wouldn't say it was perfectly suited to the American buying public's tastes. You know, one of the beauties of the Japanese cars is they're very smooth, they're very quiet. I mean, even the little ones, it's remarkable how much that type of that characteristic they build into them. And the French, and you can't be as categorical as this, I suppose, but generally speaking, they want something that'll go fast, and they don't give a damn if it's noisy and you have to shift gears a lot, and it's a little rough handling and so on. That it you see people, the way people drive in France and the things that they like in their automobiles, it never achieved that level of what I call refinement from a pure luxury and comfort viewpoint that some of the others did. And even though we tried, we did a lot of modifying to it of that nature, but then we followed that with the Encore, which was a two-door.
Right.
And I, you know, of course I had both of them, and they were very nice automobiles.
They did very well.
Yeah.
For a while, I think he may have entertained some thoughts that everything might go well with those two.
Yeah, well, that was certainly the hope, and it was very difficult to say exactly where the fault lay that made the program really not succeed the way it should.
Was your dealer network somewhat disheartened? At this time, or demoralized?
Well, no, I don't say I think really, because the Jeep was doing very well,
yes.
And they were looking for a small car, because the Japanese were really coming into their own at that time, and they recognized that there was no U.S. manufacturer that could effectively build a competitive small car, as I pointed out a little earlier, and so. I would say it was well received. It had some minor quality problems, which needn't have happened. But again, that in the attitude toward that sort of thing between the French buyer and the U.S. buyer is quite different. If a door handle comes off, a French buyer says, "Oh hell, but I'll use the other door." This is, put it mildly, an oversimplification.
Yeah.
But you don't have somebody coming crying back the next moment to the dealer wanting a whole new car. So that was part of it, and anyway, it was a potentially very good relationship. That, and again, back to what I said before, in my opinion, the thing that spoiled it was the political changes,
and the
lack of profit.
Right. The Mitterrand socialist government took a more heavy-handed approach to industry. Did they not?
Absolutely.
The previous administration.
Absolutely.
Do you recall any specific problems you had with them over there?
With the government?
Mm-hmm.
No, I don't.
Mm-hmm.
Because really most of our problems stemmed from the management that they would
install.
Yeah.
Levy?
Levy, yes. And
was he antagonistic to American
money? Well, let's say he he felt he had the whip hand. And we had a board meeting in Paris in February of 1967. And at that time, we're told, no, we're not negotiating with anybody. Mm. And on the 9th of March, they announced that they'd made a deal with Chrysler. And I don't know whether that'll be in the record or not, but that really burned me up. Because what the hell could we, I mean, suppose they told us on the 15th of March or up in February, what were we going to do? Go to Chrysler and tell them, oh, don't do it, it's a bad deal?
Yeah.
It was just, it's just the way some people's minds work.
Knock the props out of them.
Well, it was unnecessary, let's say.
You wouldn't have minded an orderly transition if you did it well.
It would have been better.
Yeah.
It turned out to be orderly, as a matter of fact, because Chrysler were very good about it. They, and one of the things I know, that because they've said it to me, they were absolutely astonished and happily surprised at the caliber of the people that they found at American Motors, and they moved them into very key slots.
Quite a few.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And that speaks well for what, you know, had been built over the years.
How did the French receive the Jeep? They certainly knew about it from World War II. Was there any reciprocal sales?
We started a program with them, and then Jerry Myers was really responsible for this. This was pretty. Myers. Jerry Myers was
M-Y-E-R-S.
M-Y-E-R-S, yeah. Who, in a sense, took over after Bill and I left. You know.
Bill Tippett.
Well, Tippett was in there, and then Myers came in after Tippett.
Who's Bill? Bill Tippett.
No, Paul Tippett.
Oh, I thought you said Bill. Did you say?
Oh, Bill. I was talking about Bill Lunenberg.
Yeah.
Bill Lunenberg and I, and then Paul
took
over, and then Myers became the CEO. And most of this, we've played around with it over the years, but they kept talking about they wanted a diesel engine, and we got a little Cummins and adapted it to the vehicle, but it wasn't all that great. And finally, the idea of Jeep just sort of took off in Europe. I mean, I think the reason that Renault regenerated their interest was because the public opinion customer demand, or whatever you want to call it, made it obvious that it was something they ought to be doing.
Well, when was this?
I would say 68, 9, 70, along there.
When was the actual buy-in? What was the date of that?
Wait a minute. Hold on. 78, 79, 70. Yeah, it was, yeah.
Forgive me, your fingernail makes sense. You remember Nixon's teacup rally?
Yeah. Well, I know better than that.
But did it take off? Did the Jeep in your program?
Well, it's done well in the last few years.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. It's been. You know, I'm still a decade out. It was the middle to late '80s that it really took off, because the sale to Chrysler was what. August of 87. Yeah.
And the sales were.
And it was right about that time that the Jeep began to become a hot item, a stylish item, an in thing in, Switzerland and France, and I guess to England. They were still talking about the Range Rover, but they're getting over that.
Yeah. Was it a spontaneous thing that was built up over the years, or was it something Chrysler did?
I don't think Chrysler had much to do with it, no. Chrysler was very busy.
You'd have to import it. You didn't have a dealership network,
though. That's true. Not of any dimension.
Yeah. No, forgive me, the date on the Renault buy-in again was?
Was August 87.
The Renault buy-in.
When Renault bought American Motors. But it's Renault, I beg your pardon, I think Chrysler. About 78 or 9, somewhere right in there. And we talked about it for while I was still there. But then, I retired in, you know, these dates all sort of run together. I retired in 77, as I recall. 78 it was. and it was fomenting at that time, and but it really came to pass about several months after that, as I recall it.
Somewhere in here, maybe
79.
You retired chairman of the board.
Yeah.
And you owned a large box of stock.
Well, not all that much.
Family.
No, they had pretty well. American Motors had a period when it was a darling of the stock exchange, and at least relatively speaking, and it had been a conversion from the Hudson stock. And I had a mental process which said, when American Motors gets to this level, which had been depressed after the merger, when it gets to this level, it's the equivalent of what our Hudson stock was at the time of the level. And I wrote each one of my brothers and sisters and said, it's at that level, you're on your own. Buy it, sell it, do anything you want to do, but forget about asking me what's going to happen. And I was exonerated, or whatever you want to call it. I just justified. I didn't have any. It wasn't as if I arranged the merger, yeah. but I felt sort of just a metal block that the stock was worth less than what they might have gotten for it if they sold before the merger.
And did they?
Most of them. Yeah. And I sold some myself too.
Yeah. So your negotiations with Steve Miller indicated that you would be receptive, but you wanted the best deal possible. And of course, the key selling point was the Jeep.
And the Jeep and the personnel.
And the what?
Personnel.
Yes, of course. Yeah. Right. Yeah. Of course, Steve's a very canny negotiator, I'm sure. Did he indicate to you that they felt it was a good deal? They weren't trying to rescue you?
Oh yeah. Oh no. They this was a business deal. This was not. There was no charity involved.
Good.
Believe me.
Yeah. I understand Lee desperately wanted Jeep. I had that impression when I read over the years. He was really
I think that has subsequently become apparent. Let's say. But I wasn't surprised.
Okay. Now, how about your? I don't want to delve into your personal finances, but how did, maybe take your case as a case in point? How did it work in terms of your transferring whatever block of American Motor stock you had for either for Chrysler stock or for a purchase agreement? How did that work out?
I'm embarrassed to tell you, I really can't remember.
Well, all
I know is that the American Motors shareholders, with almost no exceptions, at least none that ever surfaced in my view, thought the deal was a satisfactory deal. It was a good deal.
Well, basically, did they get Chrysler stock and some cash.
It wasn't a one for one. I forgot just what the ratio was. I can look it all up, but it's.
But it was satisfactory to all parties.
Well, I think I got one letter from somebody saying, "Why did you sell our company?" or something like that. Yeah. But you could have sold it for $100 a share and gotten a letter like that.
You must have had a certain personal qualms about the longtime family involvement.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, American Motors had been something I'd been, working at all my life, and I was, while I had retired, I was still a member of the executive committee and chairman for quite a while, and had a consulting contract with them, and I was expected, and I did. I had an office there, and I went, not unless invited, but I got invited, to come and talk with the operating people and to go out to engineering and look at the styling. And
this is Chrysler?
No, this is prior
AMC.
To the Chrysler purchase,
yeah.
But
yeah.
After my retirement. In other words, between 78 and 87.
So you have an active consultant.
So it was, yeah. And as I say, there's nothing worse than a consultant that keeps sticking his nose in when you don't need him. But there were, there are a lot of things that happened that needed a little background, and I would, at that time, of course, my memory was a lot fresher, and I was able to be useful.
You're uniquely situated, then.
Yeah, well, because I was sort of the, because Bill Lunenberg died, unfortunately.
Oh, what happened to him?
He had a heart attack.
And it took over.
Tragic.
Yeah.
Well, it was, I have to remember what year that was.
Did Tippett come up?
Yeah, Tippett did, and then what we had visualized, he and I had visualized, was that Jerry Myers, who was a very fine manufacturing man, and procurement and quality and all that sort of stuff, mm-hmm. and Bill McNeely, who was a spectacular, imaginative marketing man,
mm-hmm.
And who worked, as long as Lunenberg and I were there, worked together very well. I guess we were not very good judges of human nature, because once Bill and I left, the two of them just couldn't get along. It was a tragedy, too.
Tibbetts and Myers?
McNeely.
Oh, McNeely.
McNeely and Myers.
And Myers.
As I said, unfortunately, because both their personalities and their capabilities complemented, and it didn't work. So, but then Paul came in, which was great, because Paul is a very, very good operator. He's a very sophisticated man. He knows how to make things happen, make people do things.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, I'm going to have lunch with him tomorrow.
Mm-hmm.
He's out here in Ann Arbor, has a bunch of little companies that he's bought, and he's a great fellow. But anyway, so there was turmoil there. And which was most unfortunate, and that partly led to the I don't think that affected Renault's decision, because we were working very diligently at marketing the Renault product. But anyway, that was one of the disappointing things that occurred in the transition period.
How did Lunenberg happen to have a heart attack? Was it completely unexpected, or?
Yes, I'll tell you how unexpected, very briefly. He and I was the chairman of the Detroit Science Center, and Bill was helping me, meaning just volunteered. He said, what can I do to help you? We were having a board meeting, I ran these organization meetings about once a week. We were having an organization meeting, and Bill excused himself from the meeting room and went, I assume, to the bathroom. She did, and he didn't come back for a little while, and he had a heart attack right there. Died. Well, he didn't die right there. We got the ambulance immediately, and I went over to the hospital, and he lingered on for maybe 12 hours or so. I went out to Ann Arbor and got his wife and brought her in. It was it was pretty gruesome. Because he was not an old man at all. He's a couple years older than I was. But this is back in the 70s. Yeah. So.
Well, Myers has taken over then at this point,
and very actively encouraged the Renault relationship, which is good, and.
He consulted with you from time to time.
Yeah, less and less, but it was, and things such as product design and maybe financial relationships and so on. I had some competence and background that I was involved in that sort of thing. I had nothing to do with running the company, and nor did I want to. And Jerry was the guy that really finally put the Renault deal together. I mean, I think this was winter of 79, and it stayed together for 8 years, in varying degrees of success.
In the styling area, when did Dick T come in?
Well, I think we went through that a little bit previously, and I think even at that time I couldn't tell you.
Well, I really want to lead it up to just maybe the last few years you were there, and beyond. Was Dick good for American Motors?
Oh, Lord.
Yeah.
Expounded on previously, he was miraculous. He could take something and take nothing and make something out of it, or take something and make something different out of it for $1 million. In fact, I think I mentioned previously, we used to have a joke, I say, well, Dick, we got to have a whole new car. Here's $7 million.
Yeah. He'd say, my God.
He'd say, well, now let me see. If we do this and this and this. No, he was a genius.
A design magician, really.
Yeah, and always thinking, always. I mean, you go to lunch, you'd wind up with little scratches on the back of an envelope as to how you ought to change the rear window and this and things like that. But I loved it, and we were good friends.
Now you stayed on for a couple of years after you left.
Yes, I think so.
I've
forgotten just when he retired, but I think it was about 1980. And recently died, as you perhaps know.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
What about Vic Geraci, his successor? Remember him at all?
Geraci? Yeah, he was originally in charge of interiors and did extremely well.
Mm-hmm.
He had excellent taste.
Mm-hmm.
It didn't always jive with some of the other people there, but he normally, at least I agreed with it, which was helpful.
Yeah.
And he's one of the nicest people you ever want to meet. And incidentally, he's a very talented artist. I've got some drawings that he did for me that I have in California that are a delight. And I haven't seen Vic in 5 years, I guess. But I last time I saw him was at one of the motor shows.
I understand he was, at least the last I heard it, with Chrysler. And,
I think so.
Well.
I think so. Well, I hope so.
Well, the Chrysler situation, as you say, Renault sort of went around behind you on that, but you didn't feel believed at this point, but you did, because you felt 48% was just too much to contend with. Did you feel good about the eventual outcome of the merger or the buyout?
Yeah, looking at it from the point of view of our people, it worked out very well for
mm-hmm.
them. For the reasons I just said. From the point of view of our shareholders, I think it was the best deal that they could have gotten in light of the lack of profitability of both Renault and AMC. And it's you might say it kept it in the industry, it kept it in America,
yeah.
It kept it alive here. From the point of view of the dealers, I would say it was also a good deal, because in most cases they kept Jeep and they added Eagle to it. And Chrysler didn't make any big waves in the distribution field. I mean, they didn't have any wholesale canceling of outlets or anything of that nature. No, I'd say that the first of all, Chrysler handled it very well. They did a good job. When putting two organizations like that together. We went through this back in the Nash Hudson days. You're liable to wind up with a us and them mentality,
mm-hmm.
Or we and they,
mm-hmm.
and I spent a lot of time back in 1954 and 55 trying to make sure that didn't happen. As one of the few Hudson representatives that had any position, and not much at that. Anyway, it didn't. You saw very little of that. I mean, I'd go over. I've only done it a couple of times, but I. Well, we talked to Castagne. He wanted to show me the upcoming, what is now the Grand Cherokee, and
yes.
Go over some styling ideas they had. And I was standing in the styling department, the engineering department, in the lobby, waiting for Francois to come down or wherever he was. And the shift changer, it was 5 o'clock, let's say, and these guys came out. And I'll tell you about every fifth person came out. Hi, Mr. Chair. You know, they were ex-American Motors people. Yeah, which is very gratifying to me.
Was there was that a condition of the sale? Did you insist on a certain number of key people being transferred?
No, not specific.
Job protection.
Oh, we had pretty good. Well, there was some arrangement under which you talk about job protection.
Yeah.
There was some arrangement which I don't recall, under which if they were laid off, if they were discharged, they got some form of. Farewell compensation, but I don't really remember what that was.
Well, they did take some pretty key people. Didn't they take Tibbetts to run their overseas division for a while?
No, that was Joe Cappy.
Oh, Cappy, that's
yeah,
right.
Yeah, Joe, who had become president.
Yes.
And
he'd taken over from Tibbetts.
Yeah, I think Tippett was chairman at the time, yeah. And Joe was, he had, I think he came originally from Christchurch, as far as that goes, but that's not important. He still runs, he's still their vice president of international. And I talked to him a couple of weeks, 3 weeks ago, and I think he's doing well. He says it's a different world, but we knew that was going to be, he knew it was going to be like that.
But he's doing well.
Yeah.
Any other key people you remember that level or immediately below?
Well, I'll tell you one in particular.
Castang, of course, you mentioned.
Yeah, but John Tierney, who was our vice president and controller, mm-hmm. Is now the chairman of Chrysler Credit. He runs the whole credit operation.
Tierney?
T-I-E-R-N-E-Y. He's a very capable guy. He and I spent a lot of time together back in the days of the banks.
Really?
And yes, and he, and in fact, I had lunch with him about a month ago. Okay. He's got his problems now with the credit ratings of the corporation, but he's surviving, and they made one third of the Chrysler. I'll put it another way. They made a lot of money last year without going into any details, because Chrysler hasn't broken it out, I don't think.
The credit usually does.
It should. Yeah.
Then there was, of course, Victor Acy went over from the design, and tell us a bit about Francois Castaing. He's rather interesting.
Well, he was obviously, he came from Renault.
Mm-hmm.
And
his origin?
Oh, yeah. He was. I don't know if they called him that. Chief engineer, but he was an engineer on the American Motors related products.
Okay,
that I know. Now, what else he might have done, I don't know. And we used to see him regularly in France, and he used to come over here a lot. And he's a very facile man. He has wide interests. He has great ability and a very good way about him. He coming over. In a sense, cold like that. He moved into our engineering department, and it was a blessing. And he really is. He's very good, which of course is why he's running all the Chrysler engineering.
And they recognize him easily. He's now the vice president in charge of engineering.
Yes.
Development. What about the dealer relationship? I was always fascinated. Like, this is still in place. Tell us about the Eagle and the. How that set up the Jeep Eagle division for Chrysler, if you recall. Was the Eagle a Renault product?
No. No, not really. It was the Eagle was a four-wheel drive version of the Concorde.
Oh, okay.
You really want to know in fact, Bob Evans was the father of that.
Was he really?
And we've talked about Bob before, but he believed firmly in a four-wheel drive compact car. And in fact, he still drives one.
Yeah.
And I rode with him a little while ago, and it's in beautiful shape. Anyway, that was our move in the direction of a passenger car or a station wagon, you want to call it, or a sedan with four-wheel drive. And it's a good car.
Mm-hmm.
And you still see them, particularly in places like Vermont and Colorado and so on. They're still running.
That was the duration of Hubble's ever.
Well, it was, we never visualized any big volume, but we did know you could get a lot more money for a four-wheel drive than you could for a conventional two-wheel drive, as we discovered through Jeep. And we built a reasonable number of them, but it had a good name, and it had a good reputation as a car. And I think what Chrysler decided was, as long as they had to give a product to the Jeep dealers, that they would give them the Eagle, and then they would add to that Renault-built products, which would carry the Eagle name. And they're good products.
That's the way it turned out.
Yeah. And generally speaking, I think it's been a very satisfactory move. Now, they're talking today about we have too many lines, and do we discontinue Plymouth, or do we discontinue Eagle, or whatever. I guess what I would do is unimportant, but they're going to pick whichever one they think they can make the most money with.
What would be your suggestion if they asked?
I don't think they're making any money with Plymouth, as far as I can tell. I mean, how the hell do I know?
Well, loyalty aside, I think the Eagle probably would.
Yeah, well, it's a good name. it hasn't really gotten off the ground. That's the big detriment there. It's going to take a real push to get that moving, but they've got some new product with that name on it for next year, I'm told, which I haven't seen.
I've seen some spy photos. The whole line
is
gorgeous.
Yeah, the line as a whole is an admirable job.
Now that's Tom Gale, I guess, who's shepherded that through.
Yeah, that's Steve.
Did you ever know Tom?
No.
I never met him. I guess it's a price of pride. Well, I guess an overview would be interesting in the last 20 minutes we have is to talk about, I think generally you've been admirable in giving overviews along the way, but.
Well, I try to, just so you understand, I know you do,
yes.
That this is not a chronology of the automobile industry.
No,
this is just flashbacks and insights and stuff, which I would assume, from your purposes, are a lot more interesting than if I say on January 15th so-and-so did such and such, because that's hopeless.
Exactly. No, I know you wouldn't want to do that even if you could. No, I think it's more, since it's your interview, I would like to focus in on your feelings, sort of sitting back now, you've been out now, 10 years, you're not really out of the business, but you've been out of the actual management.
Yeah.
And you've noticed the developments both here and abroad, and looking back on it, you had a wonderful career, your father had a wonderful career, you had a wonderful career with Hudson, and then the formation of American Motors. How do you feel about your whole life looking back on one swift flash? Slow flash.
Oh boy.
Would you have done anything differently? Something major?
I don't think so.
No.
I mean, I achieved my objective, which was to head a company that was part of its genesis was the company that my father headed.
Yes.
And then that's very important to people who, if you have a strong family identity.
Mm-hmm.
And because he was a very, very well-known, very successful man, and sometimes the firstborn always doesn't get quite as far as they'd like to,
mm-hmm.
doesn't turn out to be, assuming they want to be like their father, and I'm nothing like him. That wasn't the point, but I mean, but to follow in the footsteps, you might say. And
excuse me, right there. How are you different from your father?
Well, I think I may be a little more attentive to detail. I may not be as broad a personality, have as broad a range of interests as he. He loved everything that had to do with the structure of the industry and its relationship with the government and one country versus another country and so on. I'm not all that great at that. I mean, I've been through it. But. And my interests perhaps are more of personal gratification. Like I love to fish and I love to shoot and I love to travel and I love to run my ranch and I do and all that kind of stuff. Which he had his interests were much broader than mine. To some extent, I think we had the same characteristics in that he was very good at getting people to do what he wanted them to do. I've been quite successful at that, one way or another.
I suspect you've been rather low key. Persuasion was part
of it. Yeah, low key. I've found got me a lot farther than some other. There are a lot of emotional people in this business, and who knows? Maybe it wasn't the way to go, but it worked for me.
Right.
And as far as to answer your basic question, I would feel that I've been very fortunate in the way that my life has turned out. I have good health, happy, got a family that's all together, that's not in the newspapers all the time. I have a second marriage with, again, four children, so I have eight children. And that does get a little, it's a little hard to spread all the sentiment around, let's say, but that's not a major problem. And I'm perfectly content with, I still have enough responsibilities in business, and to my family, not only emotionally but financially, that I have a very happy life, very lucky life. I have a beautiful ranch in California, I have an operation here, I have a nice, in other words, all the physical aspects are everything you could ask for, and I don't have any financial problems. I'm not about to go out and buy a yacht, but anyway,
you
it's
in the desert in California.
Yeah, I don't like yachts anyway. Yeah. But it's I guess the answer is I'm maybe oversatisfied. I shouldn't be so content.
Raise horses out there, cattle.
We run some cattle. Like, we don't raise them. We just pasture them. Mm-hmm. But and we've got. I have a very good horse, which. And my wife had two. He died recently. And I ride quite a lot, and we have a wonderful group of friends that really are all new, because we've only been out there 10 years. I am still a Michigan resident. I'm, I vote here. My
office
house here. I have a house in Grosse Pointe, yeah. And I come back here.
You lease it while you're gone?
No. Just
caretaker.
It's there. I have somebody comes in and looks at it. Sure. And no, it's I love to be able to come back and just. I can travel without a toothbrush.
Isn't it wonderful?
Yeah, it really is. So, except I usually am loaded down with so much paper that. Anyhow, if that's the summation, I'm a happy man.
Well, let me just, since we've got about 10 minutes left, let me resort to a rather hoary device and ask you about just a sort of a capsule on people. Let's start with your father. Can you give me a capsule description?
Well, I just did. Yeah, he was a man of great. He was very solid, very. But he had a flair, and he was very good with people. He had an idea of what he wanted to do, where he wanted to go, and he got there. He was tremendously interested, as I said, in government relations, which is one of the reasons he wound up as Secretary of Commerce.
Very good at that.
And, well, in a period when I don't know anybody could have been good at it. You know, if you can imagine going around telling, you remember the prosperity is just around the corner?
Yeah. Just to pick out a few, George Mason, do you remember much about George Mason?
Yeah, I do, and we talked about that before.
Yeah.
George was a very gregarious man. He had more men friends, and I, through a stroke of fortune, became a good friend of his, I believe. And as I indicated in the previous discussion we had, I used to shoot ducks with him, and he would invite me down as an unpaid guide.
Mm-hmm.
He had a beautiful fishing place, and we shared the same interests, and we were both interested in conservation activities. That's where I got us to really to know him, was with Ducks Unlimited, which is a major conservation effort. And he had great personal friends working for him, and I mean they were all just good friends. They all went off on trips together, but that didn't diminish their capabilities, believe me. They were very competent men, some of them from Ford, some of them from wherever. But he also had a very informal way of operating. Maybe they had, I didn't know in those days, that maybe they had reports and so on, but I think it was mostly George would call them in and say, "Oh, look, why don't we do this and this and this?" And then Romney had to kind of follow up on it, because George Romney was the executive vice president at the time. But Mason was a delightful man. It was a crime. Obviously, that it was sin that he died.
Did he die early?
Yeah, well, the merger was in May of 54, and he died in October.
Oh, really?
Yeah, he barely had time to put it together. It really wasn't together yet. Romney had to kind of tie up, but it took, anything like that takes a couple of years.
Leading into that, what's your assessment of Romney as a businessman, George Romney?
Well, George had some talents that I've never met anybody at the equivalent. He was a spellbinder, but at the same time a good businessman. He understood business. He wasn't just an evangelist, and I spent a lot of time with him, and he had other interests which he didn't neglect. He was very much involved in the church. Mm-hmm. And when he and I would go abroad together, he every major town that we went to, well, specifically let's say London and Paris, mm-hmm. He would have a stake of the Mormon church that he would go and address at some point in the course of our trip, and mm-hmm. and that kind of thing, which is wonderful, and it was a big part of his life. And he had the highest principles of any man I've ever encountered in the automobile business, or maybe anywhere else.
He had a compromise a bit when he got involved with this.
Well, yeah, I talked to him after he became governor, and it was a, as he knew it would be, it was quite a shock to him what a difference it was. And this is something that Perot is going to find out. Between being a CEO and being a governor or a president or whatever, you don't just say, "Look, boys, this is how it's going to be. Now go do it."
Yeah. I remember I was involved with Citizens for Mission for a while. We felt betrayed when we announced his running for the Senate. What about the Kaiser family, father and son? Do you have much to do with that?
Well, I met Father Henry years ago, back about 1936, I think it was, mm-hmm. when they came out expressing an interest in buying into Hudson. Mm-hmm. And we had a meeting at the Whittier Hotel, I guess, and my mother and I went, and they made quite a presentation, but it was one that just didn't fly. The Kaisers, this is a personal evaluation, were basically extractive people, aluminum, steel, gravel, etc. And very good at it. I spent a lot of time with Edgar, the son, who was then running. Henry had died back in 1969 and 70 when we bought Jeep, because Edgar and I had basically agreed on it. But
you had informally.
We had agreed that we're going to make a deal. We're going to put this thing together. Edgar was one of those guys, a wonderful man, who said, "Well, now, Roy, I'll tell you what, we've agreed. Why don't you take Ian Anderson or one of your top financial guys, and I'll take so-and-so, put them together, let them work out the details." Right. I said, "Edgar, that's not me. I'm a Virgo. I want to see all the T's and all the I's." Yeah. And he said, "Well, that's up to you." So we used to play little games as to whether we would have the meeting in Toledo or in Oakland and that kind of stuff. But it was a lot. He and I became good friends. And he had a Steve Girard that was running the Jeep end, stayed on as a director of American Motors, and is still. I talked to him just the other day. He's still a friend in California. He lives in California,
he's
not
retired.
Far from us.
Retired.
Oh yeah.
He's quite a force there in that division.
Steve, yeah, he was. Well, there was Edgar, Gene Trefethen, and then Steve.
He
Trefethen, Trefethen, and he was the. I guess Edgar was chairman, Gene was president and CEO, and Steve was executive vice president. So it's he left. Well, they both retired. Well, of course, Kaiser Industries is disintegrated now, as far as I know. It doesn't exist anymore. So I mean, it's owned by names. So some of the names exist, but they're owned by other people and so on.
Mostly aluminum.
Yeah, but that's owned by somebody else, I think. I may be wrong. I really haven't paid much attention to it since everybody I knew cut out.
Everybody I know on the West Coast belongs to their health plan.
Oh yeah, that's been a booming success.
Right.
So the Kaisers were very much involved in our past and future.
Mm-hmm. Did you inherit a fairly good network of Jeep dealers when you bought them?
Not as good as we'd hoped.
You had to restructure.
And we had one interesting aspect to it. Yeah, we needed to add was that the Jeep dealers, a lot of them were old Jeep dealers, and they were used to saying, "No, the sheet metal in the fender is this thick," you know, that kind of stuff. And I'm not kidding you. Bill Lunenberg and I went around personally and talked to these guys to assure them that just because we were automobile men, we weren't going to screw up the Jeep. And I mean, this was a matter of real concern. We had to demonstrate to them that our manufacturing techniques, or at least tell them and have the hope that they would understand that we were going to improve the product, which we did.
You obviously worked closely with Bill Lunenberg. Can you give us sort of an epitaph on that relationship and his abilities with AMC?
Well, I mentioned one little incident. Bill was an action man. He couldn't stand sitting around negotiating, which was turned out to be my job in most cases. And as I think I told you, when we got to an impasse with the banks back in 67, January of 67, he and I first came in, and we got the banks, and Bill just, we were going through this negotiation, and finally Bill just got up and he said, all these guys are saying, we're not going to lend you any money, you just have to figure your own way out of this. Bill got up and he held a bunch of his house keys up and he said, here are the keys to the plant, now which one of you sons of bitches wants them? And that was it. That broke. I said, I'll see you all tomorrow morning. but he was that kind of a guy. He was also the kind of guy that people, he could just really go up one side and down the other of you if you'd done something wrong. Mm-hmm. And when half an hour later, you just loved it. He realized he was right. Uh-huh. And he was unique.
Well, thank you, Mr. Shea. It's been most instructive.
Well, we haven't added much to the history of the automobile business, but
I think
we've got a few little sidelines.
Well, I think more importantly, we've added quite a bit to understanding your career and your personality.
Well,
very important.
Be that as it may.
Thank you.
Enjoy it, Dave.